Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. Now, today I would like to talk about my erstwhile boss, colleague and friend, Professor Richard Lynn, who died on Monday the 17th of July at the age of 93, peacefully, which is, of course, very unfortunate. And it is fair to say that I simply wouldn't be doing what I am doing today if it wasn't for him. I tweeted this out, and I didn't know that nobody else had done so, with the result that the tweet has been viewed numerous times, and most people have reacted very positively, in the sense, not positively that he's died, but positively to the huge contribution which he made to science. He discovered the Flynn effect, he discovered all kinds of interesting things about IQ differences and so on. And there were a few unpleasant haters saying things like they were left-wing people, obviously, because they're so compassionate, saying things like that they were glad he had died and so forth, and that he will be in hell. But all I can say to that is, if heaven is where people like that are going, then I would rather be in hell, because hell will be full of logical, reasonable, mentally stable kind of people. So hell's probably a much better place to be than heaven in their theology. Now, so what I wanted to talk about in this video really was some of my memories of Richard. I first came across him, really, well, without knowing it, it would have been the mid to late 1990s, and I was watching The Mikado live at some theatre in London, and there was a song called I've Got a Little List, and the song made a reference to professors who were saying that the brain of one sex is smaller than the other. And that was a reference to Richard Lynn, who had been in the newspapers at the time for saying this. But I only really realised who he was when in the mid-2000s, when I was just looking through some books at Ola University Library and happened to find one of his books on group differences in intelligence. And slowly, I built up the confidence to start corresponding with him. And I started to realise that the environmental determinism with which I, doing a theology degree and a religious studies a doctorate, have been inculcated was clearly wrong, and it was particularly wrong in relation to religion and in relation to differences between ethnic groups, which was what I had been looking at the time. He was always extremely polite. He would always reply. You get some celebrity academics or whatever who think they're too good to reply. They'll say, "Oh, I get so many emails, I can't possibly reply." All this, not they won't put their email on the website. They'll put one of those annoying forms that you put in, you know, so they can basically just an excuse to make it look like they want to correspond with people, but of course they don't. Richard Lynn wasn't like that at all. He would always reply and so forth, and we got to know each other corresponding. And then eventually, it must have been 2011. He started giving me a little bit of funding to do various bits of work here and there. And then in 2012, he offered me funding to research the relationship between a book on the relationship between religiosity and intelligence. And this completely changed everything. I can't see how if that hadn't happened. Maybe there would be some other means by which I'd have got into based science. But that was definitely the turning point in age of about 31. That I went from being a journalist and doing sort of cultural anthropology and things to doing based science. And then after that, we first met in Bristol. He invited me to come to Bristol. I happened to be in England for Christmas, and he invited me to come to Bristol to see him right at the beginning of the new year of 2013, or was it, I think it might have been just at the end of 2012. And he picked me up. He was 80, we have been 81 years old, and I was very nervous, and I got to the car park at the railway station in Bristol, and I was looking for him, like, where is he? And then eventually there was this very, just in the distance, I saw this very short, hunched over elderly man with bright white hair sort of waving something at me, because he realizing it was me, he found a picture of me from somewhere, I suppose. And so I went to some little Ford Fiesta or whatever he was driving, some little car. And so first of all, he drove me over to Bristol's oldest pub, which was medieval, and we had a look around that. And then he took me to some large church in Bristol, where I sort of nearest thing they have to a cathedral in Bristol, I suppose, where William Chatterton was buried and this sort of thing. And that was very interesting. And took me around some park. And then he took me for a very nice lunch. I remember I had pasta with Italian restaurant, pasta with duck and so forth. And then he drove me around a bit more and then commented on how he's very, very elderly and very tired. And he sort of conks out in the middle of the day. And so if you don't mind, perhaps I could drop you off at the railway station now, which he did many hours earlier than my train. And it's a long way from London to Bristol. It's about 3 hours. So, and he gave me a book which he'd found on religion or something like this, and said, "Hey, well, we'll take that. You've got plenty to read." So, and then off he went. And then after that, we did various for the next year. We did various papers together, and the book that resulted was Religion. Here we go: Religion, Intelligence, and Evolutionary Analysis. And then the following year, he said, "Well, what about next year? What do you want to do next year? I'd rather like you to do a book on the relationship between race and sport." So that was then 2012 or 2013 into 2014. This book, which was, well, it did well enough that it's been translated into Russian. So that was that year, and then we wrote various articles together on that issue, on race and sport, and we'd done other things on the Flynn effect and various other topics. And then in 2014, he invited me to the first ever London Conference on Intelligence. And I hadn't seen him since the end of 2012. We'd spoken on the phone a bit and whatever, but I corresponded on email, but I hadn't actually seen him. And by then it was getting interesting. I mean, I was published in Intelligence, which was this major journal and which people actually cite. So to go from being a cultural anthropologist to publishing in a major journal, you know, a journal people actually cite, it's actually interesting, was quite a significant thing. And in the meantime, I'd been corresponding with a few people who he put me in touch with, such as Michael Woodley. And then I got to the conference, which was at this London Gentlemen's Club. And it was like the first day at school, or like being a new boy, I guess, at the first day at school, because I didn't know anybody. But everybody seemed to know everybody else. And I went in and Richard, Ed! And he was sitting with Kenya Kura, who is a Japanese researcher who's done research with me on the intelligence and personality among Japanese, been genius among Japanese people, and then gradually through him I got to know all these other people, and then you start having a great deal in common with them, and you realise that you're all in it together, these sorts of thick as thieves based researchers who are fighting against insanity and wokeness, and that was what he helped facilitate. That was what he helped to bring about. And I carried on writing articles with him and papers with him. And the next year, he had this idea that I should do something on extending J. Philippe Rushton's RK model, which became this eventually, J. Philippe Rushton: A Life History Perspective. There you are. I remember him telling me, speaking of death, that he was rather upset that J. Philippe Rushton was his best friend and was the best man at his wedding, at his third wedding, Richard. And J. Philippe Rushton hadn't told him he was dying or anything. And he said, "You're meant to be your best friend. He doesn't even tell you this." You know, he was a little bit hurt by that. And so that was that project. And then it just carried on. And we had further London. Richard would continue working. I mean, by this time now, we're talking in his mid-80s. No intention of spending his retirement going as far as the local pretty town, little quaint town, and having a cup of tea and coming home. He would spend, to a certain extent, a sort of a half working day at his computer doing his research, even right up to in his 90s, and certainly at that stage. And it would be doing papers with me, doing papers with other people. That was the kind of work ethic that he had. And he was always so incredibly polite and so incredibly helpful and so incredibly willing to try and help people out and to try to find. I suppose he saw me as a kind of protege, and there were other proteges that he saw as well. And with the funding to which he had access, he would always do what he could to try and ensure that it's difficult to get funding for this kind of research, but he would always do everything he could to assist. It was quite extraordinary considering he's this evil scientific racist, what a kind, polite, reasonable and hard-working man he was. And the next project then he wanted me to do something on was ethnocentrism, which became this book. And then the next one was an idea that myself and Michael had, which was on something on the decline and fall of intelligence. Now, of course, he had written a book on this called Dysgenics. But one of the things that Richard did, and I guess it was because of the generation he was, I mean, remember, he was born in 1930, he got his doctorate in 1956. He would write in this incredibly formal scientific style, incredibly dry, which is weird because when you read his memoirs, they are extraordinarily well written. I mean, most of it is anyway. It's like reading a novel. I mean, it's incredibly well written stuff. So he was obviously a brilliant writer, but he had been taught that when it comes to science, that you must write in this very dry style. No personal anecdotes, no illustrations from real life, nothing like that. Those things must be kept separate. So he did not write popular science books. And myself and Michael had this idea that, no, this should be a popular science book and it should be presented in such a way that it draws in the average layman, that it's interesting, that it makes them think about everyday life and so on, that there's anecdotes, that there's jokes. And that's, of course, exactly what we did. And that's what differentiated it from Dysgenics. And he understood that and the importance of that. And so he funded the writing of that book as well. And it all was like this. He would always or almost always come to the London Conference on Intelligence. He would often stand to do his speeches, even though he needed a stick to walk, and he was becoming increasingly hunched over. And he would always do these incredibly coherent and polite speeches. And then he would always often at his own expense, take all of us out for meals. And things like this to celebrate the conference and so forth. He was an incredibly generous and kind man. Obviously, he was an elderly man, and certain things kind of happen to the mind as one gets older, which are unfortunate. And I'm afraid those things did rather happen to him. With certain consequences, certain papers that he accidentally published twice and therefore needed to be withdrawn, or as the person that was in charge of a particular project with me, being most insistent that a certain master's thesis did not need to be cited because it contained the military data, and the military data was surely open to everybody, and so therefore it wasn't cited, and therefore we got done for plagiarism. Or what else? Well, in his memoirs, you can see that it's all very well written, and I suspect he wrote almost all of this up to the age of about 82. 83, and then towards the end it stops being well written. It basically just becomes a series of diary entries that aren't very well done at all. And obviously he wasn't aware this was happening to him, or he was aware. He once said to me when he asked me for a copy of a paper, I'd written. I said, well, I wrote this with you. Don't you know that you were the co-author on this paper? He said, oh, God, yes, so I am. Oh, God, my mind must be going as I get older. So he was kind of aware of it. And it was, I mean, for things like there was a paper that he published in Personality and Individual Differences on group differences in penis size. And the data was fake. I mean, the data was fake. But being a very elderly man and being naive and it not occurring to him that anyone would do something so egregious, he found the data, wrote the paper. It was published in Personality and Individual Differences. And of course, the data was fake. And even the reviewers, I don't remember that the reviewers were his kind of age as well, didn't understand this. And it was published. So there were things like that towards the end. I mean, there is a level on which when you're that elderly, maybe it's a good idea if you kind of retire from writing at about 80, and spend time playing bridge, which he loved doing, or spend time with your grandchildren or your wife or whatever it happens to be. But on the other hand, that's not him. That wasn't him. He was absolutely motivated by discovering the truth, by discovering the nature of the world in more detail, by collecting a group of differences in IQ, by all of these things that he wanted to do. And that was his absolute passion. That was what he wanted to do. And he saw retirement, as he told me, he saw retirement as a means to be able to do that. Because you had certain restrictions when he was still working at the University of Ulster. He founded the psychology department at the University of Ulster in the early 70s. And that department, by the way, in the wake of the London Conference on Intelligence for All, cancelled, I mean, very cowardly, cancelled his Emeritus Professorship. There would be no such department. It wasn't him, it wouldn't exist. But rather spinelessly or in order to virtue signal that that's what the pathetic department at the University of Ulster did. But of course, he didn't care, and his retirement just allowed him to just pursue whatever academic interests he wanted to, which he did, as far as I know, right up to the end. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there are a number of unpublished papers. I mean, the last book that he was involved in, I think I've got a copy of it here, was a Feitschrift to Helmut Nyborg, who, by the way, is himself 86, and you wouldn't know it. And Richard was the editor of this, and this was published in late May, I think it was, or even early June, late May. And Richard, of course, was by then seriously ill. I'm very glad to have known him. A lot of us would think that our research interests, our research, the stuff that we've done, would not be what it was if it wasn't for Richard Lynn. We stand on the shoulders of Richard Lynn. Even the Flynn effect, we'll call it the Flynn effect, but it wasn't actually James Flynn that discovered the Flynn effect, i.e. the temporal rise in IQ scores across time in Western countries. It was Richard Lynn. But for some reason, Charles Murray, Flynn was the one that wrote a really big paper on it, and Charles Murray christened it the Flynn effect. But it wasn't Charles Murray, it wasn't Flynn that discovered it, it was Lynn. But Lynn, of course, so modest and so forth, he didn't seem to mind. But some people call it the Lynn-Flynn effect or whatever for this reason. It was Lynn that published on this first, and on many other things. So obviously we're all tremendously sad that he's gone. But no matter what the enemies of science, the I love scientists think, his legacy is going to live on. And everyday experience is, of course, consistent with his theories, which he so fearlessly pursued, rather than their theories. So I would just say, rest in peace, Professor Richard Lynn. We're not going to see your luck again, I'm afraid.